shorter version probably belong to one group and the longer version to another. Here is how the situation appears. Apparently, there was originally one book of the four Gospels. We have been trying to put the books together for the best part of 20 centuries. And what actually seems to have occurred is that the book was taken apart in the first place. Now, this was not done by any malice or any evil intent. But it is very possible that we are dealing with the Logia, or the mysterious book of the words of Jesus Christ. This book, which will only exist, mentioned, but mentioned many times by reputable writers, by saints and scholars and priests of the Ante-Nicene period. But this book may have had a kind of general circulation, and it was sent at various times to certain centers of the Christian communion in Asia Minor and North Africa. Here it remains. Perhaps it was turned in at the time of the Nicene Council and destroyed. If so, a few persons remembered it and remembered the circumstances and the general structure of it. And what appear to be the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and perhaps even John, are one book that had been placed in four widely different localities and left there for several hundred years. From what we can learn, Mark went to the book of Mark, not the apostle. Mark, the book of Mark, went to Rome. And the entire development of the gospel according to Mark developed in Rome. The book of Matthew went to Antioch and belongs to one of the seven churches which are in Asia. The book of John is the same book that went to Ephesus and remained there for several centuries. In the course of these several centuries, there were important schismatic divisions within the church. The Eastern Church broke away. It is possible that the manuscripts were lost or destroyed at the Nicene Council. And then the various people went home, and in the course of time, from memory or from whatever sources were available, perhaps other manuscripts, they recopied these works, each time making certain variations due to and perfectly consistent with the troubles they were having on the political level, that is, religious part. Well, these churches were divided from each other on certain doctrines. For example, the Church of Ephesus was the great mystic church of early Christendom. The reason being that Ephesus was a melting pot, the converging of all the caravan routes. And Ephesus has been said to be very much like the cauldron of the witches who would make Macbeth. Everything got there, mingled and boiled and fumed together. Ephesus was a great center of transcendentalism. It was the center of the worship of the great goddess Diana, mother of mysteries. It was the crossroads of the east and west. It was the caravan route which brought news from Egypt, Chaldea, Babylon, Persia, and other distant places. And out of the Church of Ephesus, there seems to have come what are called the Johnite writings, which are the Gospel according to St. John and the Apocalypse, or the Revelation of St. John, every element and ingredient of which was available at Ephesus. Now, the Roman work, which was very essentially and definitely the work, the Gospel of Mark, remained stamped throughout its reconstruction with the peculiar historical accuracy, the detail, the familiarity with such knowledge as would be essential to a country that was colonizing and had colonized Syria. The Gospel of Mark carries the orderly development almost of Roman law. Matthew has the contact apparently with Antioch and its very reactionary attitude toward Rome and toward the rise of this new sect among the Syrian people. It is therefore from the available manuscript descent rather possible, we don't say anything dogmatic about it, but rather possible that we are dealing, obviously, with the descent of one word through several centuries. We have many parallel examples to show that this situation could be the explanation. Because in the interval, for instance, between the 4th and the 7th century in Europe, the manuscripts of the New Testament found in the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus went through equally important modifications. Therefore, the lapse of 3 or 4 centuries in an area with its own peculiar beliefs and ideas, and an area which was not able to have direct contact with Jewish history, would account for certain discrepancies in the historical record, which are irreconcilable, and also would explain a certain naivete in the handling of historical material, because the people involved now had no particular contact with the history. And as the historical significance faded out for them, we find great changes, crisscrosses, and inconsistencies, which would indicate that at no time prior to Nicaea and even after that, did the fathers sit down together, read the 4 Gospels, and attempt to integrate them. They did not attempt any crisscrossing between them. Remember, in one, of course, Judas goes out and hangs himself. Another one, he goes and buys a field of land and does other things. One, he dies by accident. One, he dies by suicide. The circumstances have become unimportant. The carrying on of the major trend of the thinking and its development along the religious and philosophical implications had gradually taken over importance in the historical phases has lifted into secondary place. They could no longer be verified for that matter, because the histories of these countries were not available in those areas. So we have what appears from careful study to be the breaking up of one story, or rather not its actual breaking up, but the same story being placed in 4 different localities and then allowed to develop there. But probably one of the most excellent examples of this is the carrying of this story to Ethiopia. Because we know that the gospel reached Ethiopia. And we know that by 3 or 4 centuries later, the Ethiopic gospels and the commentaries on them had lost all semblance to what we know in the West. And yet, they are still one of the most valuable sources of information. Because this particular group was completely free from the confusion and struggle that later distinguished the descent of the Western Church. We know also that even after the Council of Nicaea, the Eastern and Western Church broke over the validity of some of these books. We know, for example, for a long time, the Eastern Church accepted the Apocalypse and the Western Church rejected it. We know then that the situation was later reversed. And still later, Martin Luther left the Apocalypse entirely out of his great translation of the German Bible because he said it was not an inspired book. And he ordered that in all future editions of his Bibles, If the apocalypse was included, it should be accompanied by that note by him to the effect that he did not regard it as an inspired work. No one paid any attention to him, however, including Lucifer.
But the book itself has been under controversy for centuries. And the reason for this controversy and the extent of it is well worth a certain amount of thought. Now, we have carefully avoided in this discussion any reference to the contents of the four Gospels. The general outline of the content is so well known to all of us that it would be redundancy to tell the story again. But there are certain phases of the matter which may still be of considerable vitality. Because as early as the 3rd century, and the 4th certainly, when the great Council of Nicaea came into function, the problem of the gradual transformation of this structural book into the basis of a canonical literature was going on. The rise of the Bishop of Rome and the integration of the Western Church was accompanied by two great waves of scholarship. The first, as we have mentioned, was the Anti-Nicene motion, and the second was the Post-Nicene, which followed the Council of Nicaea. And the first and great outstanding name after the Council of Nicaea was St. Augustine of Hippo. And with Augustinianism, we find the beginning of the gradual integration of the doctrines of Christianity into a great legal code, a great moral ethical structure. Prior to that time, it had been composed of little groups functioning alone in the wilderness, in their isolated ecclesia or chapels and churches. But after this period, we find a powerful integration. And this powerful integration immediately resulted in what Wesley termed the great cycle of interpretation. Now, interpretation had its effect upon the descent of the biblical text, because interpretation became a matter strongly emphasizing the choice of words. Now, the original idea was not to choose words. Actually, the choice of the word was dependent upon the meaning of the term. But in the most ancient languages, including Greek and Hebrew, words have more than one meaning. And the problem of interpretation can affect translation and can affect it strongly. For instance, five Greek scholars belonging to five different Christian sects, confronted with a certain statement in the Bible, can honestly and sincerely come up with five different translations, because the words themselves permit it. And the interpretation is perfectly legitimate, but it is difficult to determine sometimes which of these reasonable translations is the correct one. This led to certain revisions in translation. Now, we know that the New Testament began, perhaps, in Syria, or at least parts of it, but we haven't yet. Nor do we actually know with certainty very much except fragments, some few ancient fragments left. But we don't have anything of the consecutive nature. So that actually our New Testament begins in Greek. We do not know at this time how to evaluate that Greek. We do not know how close it was to the unknown original, because that unknown original has not survived. Therefore, we must accept the Greek. We can do nothing else. We know it, no other approach to it. We can go no further, unless the gods are gracious enough to bestow further manuscript discovery. We cannot edit the Greek. beyond this point. We do know, however, that in the second century, the Greeks began to move into the Latin. And that in the first 150 years, approximately, it was all Greek. There was no other available form. Then, in the middle of the second century, or near the end of it, Latin began to be important. The Greek language began to fail as a common language of civilized people. And the Latin form took its place. Now here we had a great motion of translation. A translation motion that is some way reflected into the Greek manuscripts that we have, because the ones we have are later than this. We do not know whether the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus are directly from the Greek, or whether they are retranslations from the Latin back into the Greek. Because between the actual period of the Gospel and the first manuscript that we have, there was this complete turnover in language. But this turnover, or this turnabout from one language to another, should have affected the church in Rome. It is certain. Because in Rome, up to about the middle of the second century, Greek was still the language of scholarship. After that, Latin the fourth. There must have been a transition in the New Testament writings from Greek to Latin. No Latin versions of this period have survived. Therefore, we can wonder whether the Greek versions of the fourth century are from the Syriac, from the Amharic, from the Latin, or from the Greek itself. This we do not know. There is no indication whatever that will tell us. We do know, however, that from the 4th century Greek translation, Latin versions were almost immediately made, and gradually versions into practically every other language of Europe. These versions are not identical. And, of course, the English versions are comparatively late. Therefore, it is not certain at just what time or under what conditions the English versions did come into existence. We know that the English versions that we have did not come directly from the Sinaiticus or the Vaticanus. They came from preceding translations, such as perhaps the Vulgate or other versions, which had passed through from 3 to 5 translations before they reached English. Anyone who has tried to read a simple poem first translated from the German into English 10 years ago will realize the difficulties of the situation. These difficulties are real. And the point of criticism is not to lead or to cause difficulties to become frustrations. That's not the purpose of it. The purpose of criticism is to try to open the way back to the original, as far as it can possibly be done, realizing from an absolutely factual survey of the mistakes in spelling, the mistakes in grammar, the mistakes in idiom that have crept in through various countries over 1,000 or more years, that the mistakes are not sacred. They are what they appear to be. And that therefore the prime problem is to try to correct them and to get a version that is nearer to the original as far as we are able to reach back toward the original, always hoping that with the passing of time we will be able to get nearer. Now all of this presupposes one thing, that is the importance of the original. If this is doubted or questioned, then the entire criticism falls to pieces. What if it is important to know, so far as it is humanly possible to know, the actual words of Jesus and his disciples? Then the criticism is valid, because it is only through this research that we can find out these very important things. And that is why biblical scholars have worked upon it so long. It is not to satisfy their own skepticism primarily. It is simply to try and find out, if they can, what was originally meant. Now, the thought, of course, supposes that what was originally meant is the most important thing we can gain from the study of this particular subject. Now, early in the 4th and 5th centuries, during the period of St. Augustine, we find the mingling of the rising school of Christian literature with that of non-Christian sects in these areas. The most important that Augustine mentioned, of course, is the Manichaean sect, which was a Persian sect in origin, and to which he himself belonged for a long time, for many years. And this sect was considered heretical by the Christians, and Augustine spent many years repenting this early membership in a non-Christian organization, along with many other things that he repented, including the stealing of apples. But the problem lay in the fact that there was a whole group of Christian material, or neo-Christian material, such as that recently discovered in the Gnostic excavation in Egypt. And we find surrounding the core of biblical literature, the New Testament, a tremendous aura of material about which we know very little as far as its relation to the originals are concerned. There is concern. We know, for example, the rise of the Islamic material found in the Quran. Now, the Quran was done in the 6th century. The Quran was therefore done within about 200 years, or 250 years, of the Codex Sinaiticus. It is an old work containing considerable material relating to the life of Jesus. Much of this material is not to be found in the Gospels. Now we can say to ourselves, perhaps Mohammed is dubious. That seems a little dubious. The reason why it seems dubious is because what relations and ties that we have with material that is known would indicate a very careful and methodical organization. It is, from the way he handled it, it is much more reasonable to assume that he took it from some source available to him. Now, we know that while he was employed as the caravan master for the rich widow, Khadijah, that he did go along the caravan route and met the Nestorian heretics. These Nestorian Christians penetrated as far as China, and in the early centuries of the Christian era, had a tremendous sphere of influence all over the Near East. They had their own books, not canonical, not accepted, but still books which perhaps they had saved from the burning of Nicaea and had taken with them into the desert. And these books did contain accounts of the life of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus, and the logia, or statements, sections of material, in his own words, which are not in the Gospel. It is very probable that Mohammed secured his material from the Nestorians because he is known to have studied with them. And the type of material which he used is a type which gained for the Nestorians their reputation for heresy. Now, at the same time, we find the rising Gnostic sect in Egypt. And the recent discoveries push back the books of the sages and the book of the Mystic Sophia considerably earlier than had previously been supposed. And we have books devoted almost exclusively to the words of Jesus, not one line of which is in the canon, and which certainly date back to the 5th or 6th century. Here we have, in the Business of Fear, the discourses of Jesus to Mary of Magdala. Very elaborate and very important. dealing with phases of his doctrine not covered by any of the existing works that are in the canon. These manuscripts were undoubtedly treasured by borderline groups, and the location of the manuscripts may associate them with what are called the Therapeutae. And the Therapeutae were a Jewish sect that flourished in Upper Egypt and had their temples there, above Philae. This Jewish sect apparently included a comparison of Christian and Jewish mysticism and was interested in the Gnosis. And in the Gnostic writings relating to Jesus, we find a great many interesting things. One of the logia, for example, is that which refers to Jesus and the dead dog, pointing the dog to his disciples, who had made unpleasant remarks about it and saying, pearls are not quite given its teeth. There are many, many such. And these are all found in related books. So we have a wide aura of religious books relating to Christianity, extending from the 4th to the 9th or 10th centuries and out into most distant and unusual areas. No effort has in general been made to gather these together and examine their common contents. There has been as yet no breaking down of the barriers between the canonical and the uncanonical books, as they are called. But Bible criticism moves past this barrier immediately and begins to examine any and all related material, anything that has the stamp of a genuine contemporary period or the internal evidence of a high degree of personal illumination or sanctity, so that the content spreads out over a much wider field than it did a few years ago. Now, the development of the interpretive mind in the church and in the various groups has led gradually to another important situation, and that is the Ante-Nicene Fathers were what were called the apologists of the church. At that time, the church was not strong. It was fighting for its survival. And in order to achieve whatever security it could, it was forced to rationalize its way along through the difficult and involved political and religious system of the time. A very good example of the Ante-Nicene Father is Clement of Alexandria. And Clement of Alexandria spent a large part of his work against heresies, as it is called, explaining and crisscrossing between the existing non-Christian systems and the early Christian faith. He says in one place, if we teach the death and resurrection of our Savior, he's addressing the Egyptians or the Romans. If we teach the death and resurrection of our Savior, we teach no more than you have taught, who have taught the death and resurrection of your Savior. This was the spirit of the Ante-Nicene apology. They were bridging across. They were trying to prevent an open break. And more than that, they were working from the fact that in those days, practically every Christian in the congregation had been born a pagan. There were very few second-generation Christians at that time. Most of them were converts. Most of them had come from other beliefs. And the Ante-Nicene Fathers were bridging as much as they could between the different systems so as to make the motion across as simple and as easy a transition in religion as possible. After the conversion of Constantine and the creation of the Holy Roman Empire, the post-Nicene Fathers took a much more positive attitude and split completely with all non-Christians. But because the Ante-Nicene period terminated at the Council of Nicaea. And because all of the books that we have date from immediately after that period, and within 50 years, there are groups of Bible scholars who believe firmly that among these various religious writings are a number, perhaps either canonical or uncanonical, in which the analogy between systems have been stressed, and that therefore in certain translations and versions, that there have been certain parallels drawn for some reason. And this gives an entirely different field of research, and one which can and does become almost immediately highly controversial. And because of that factor, we're not going to attempt to go into it more than to point out what we mean. And each student is then entitled to develop his own concepts of how this controversy should be treated. The controversy springs from, perhaps, the opening section of John. In the beginning was the Word. Or in the beginning was the Logos. Now, in the opening chapter of John, we find something that is quite difficult. There is a legend, and we say this because a legend must definitely be subtracted or divided from any factual statement, and the student is entitled to know the status of each thing. There is a legend, no more, one on which there has been considerable research, that the opening chapters of John were written much earlier than the rest of the gospel material, and perhaps before the beginning of the Christian era. The reason for that is that certain sections of it are to be found in material dating in the 3rd century B.C. But again, it is legendary, so we do not express it as more than that fact. A work attributed to a pre-Christian writer, Cerinthius, is supposed to have been incorporated into the opening chapter of John. Because it is entirely unique among the gospel narratives and in a completely different temper from the rest, that it may have had a separate or different origin is possible. We know, for instance, that at least three writers worked on Matthew, and not less than three on Mark, and that these three writers lived at least over a period of 400 years. They were not all at the same time. But the contributions that each made is a matter for technical research. It can be distinguished, however. This matter of interpretation became very, very important. And there is a question that arises that has to be solved in some way. How it is solved is very largely a matter of the personal beliefs and the personal convictions of the individual. One group will solve it very simply by taking the attitude that with God all things are possible. Therefore, that there is no problem. Others will take it more on the ground that there is a problem due to obvious dependencies upon obviously physical things. This is a matter, again, of choice. But we know, for example, that for some reason, and for purposes that obviously seem to be significant, the story contained within the four Gospels, when reduced to its essential elements, and when brought down to a pattern, is a story which contains, to say the least, highly symbolic elements. By that, we mean that the story of the life of Jesus parallels with extraordinary close many other accounts arising in different areas at different times. Interpreters approaching the subject have several solutions to offer. One is that by the very circumstances of the revelation itself, it was spiritually predestined and foreordained that this story should parallel certain other precedents. Another attitude is that in a place like Ephesus, where all these stories were available, it might well be that certain patterns were used by persons enlightened, illumined, initiated, ordained, who thereby made certain modifications upon an historical account in order that it might be identical with a larger pattern of belief. As an example, and we will just leave it exactly as it is, as an example, we will take the possible indebtedness of the story to something derived from Egypt. In Egypt, although we do not hear much about it in these days, in the early period, at the time even before, in the period from about 1500 B.C. to about 400 or 500 B.C., there was a deity comparatively prominent whose name was Nisi. This deity was born of an immaculate conception. His coming was predestined and foreordained by a great light in the heavens. He was forced to leave the country because of the fact that his life was threatened by a jealous relation who was a great prince of the land. He traveled into a distant country, came back to his own country when he was a small boy, appeared in the temple, and confounded the elders. His first miracle in Egypt, from the manuscript dated 1000 B.C., his first miracle was the changing of water into wine. He healed, he taught, he had disciples, he went through various experiences, he celebrated the Eucharist, he had his Sermon on the Mount, he was executed, buried, raised from the dead, and sat in heaven beside his Father. This record was complete at least 1000 years B.C. Now this has caused the symbolic in the critical problem of religion a certain amount of rather reasonable concern. The Dionysiac cycle has also caused some consideration. The tremendous section from the Apocalypse, which is almost verbatim from the Book of the Dead, has caused them some consideration. The Last Judgment has caused them a little thought, and many, many other sections because of the almost identical parallel. And when the Pope said in the 5th century, the 25th day of December is not so sacred for the birth of Jesus Christ as for the first day of the celestial sun, this caused consideration. And it has been one school of interpretation from the beginning that has come to the conclusion that at some time historical events were moved sufficiently around a situation itself with very thin historical boundaries to make it confirm or make it agree with the doctrine of Logos, a doctrine which we find universal at that time. The second group says no, that all other and preceding stories were but foreshadowings and anticipations of this event, that they were symbolical and that this event was real. Now that is one school of thought on the subject. These different schools then pass into what might be termed critical Bible study. And today, in the majority of theological seminaries where critical Bible study is carried on, the would-be clergyman is being taught the principles of from 10 to 15 different religions. Because it is beginning to be obvious that they are more or less essential to the critical study of Christianity itself. And that this concept of a complete isolation of the faith cannot be sustained by serious scholars. If, therefore, through criticism of text and study, we at least come to the realization of a certain broadness, a certain fullness of religious background by which peoples of various faiths can intelligently, consistently, and righteously study the religions of other peoples, we will be much nearer to the solution of our basic theological difficulties. And one of the great causes for the collapse of texts during the Dark Ages was the fact that nobody knew enough about anything to correct or clarify the situation. All of these points become parts of a legitimate study of biblical symbolism and philosophy. Now, I'd like to pause for a few moments to say something on the subject of one Bible that is of great interest to us, and that is the Authorized Version of the Great King James of 1611. This Bible is the result of a very serious difficulty that arose in England, in which two important Christian denominations locked horns over the Bible. It occurred about 1604, soon after James had ascended the throne. And in order to meet or arbitrate the difficulties of these two groups, both of whom petitioned him, King James made the statement that he had always personally felt that the insufficiency of the then available translations of the Bible. He said he did not consider the form, the wording, the selection of terms, the dignity of the translation as commensurate with the importance of the text. Therefore, he appointed a group of scholars to create the revision which we know as the King James Version. Now, actually, it is a mistake to assume that the King James Version is a new edition of the Bible. It is not. The King James Bible is a revision of the Bishop's Bible, the one that immediately preceded it. And in probably half of the text, there is not a word changed between the Bishop's Bible of 1580 and the King James of 1611. There have been a few modifications and changes. But King James himself put such a limitation on the procedure that there was very little that could be done. He forbade any variation from the Bishop's Bible unless it was absolutely necessary. But in matters of that nature, what is absolutely necessary? He forbade any change in the spellings of proper names. He forbade any eliminations of words. No word could be left out within the other. And he also forbade any new word to be added. And by the time he got through with this, practically permitted only a little juggling this way and that. There was a little polishing, and one or two audacious scholars did change the word. But it is almost a completely identical revision only, editing revision of the Bishop's Bible, which in turn was based upon the famous Breach's Bible, of which incidentally it trailed on into the Bishop's Bible, and is notable for the famous verse in Genesis, in which instead of Adam and Eve making girdles of fig leaves, in that version they made breeches of fig leaves. And this is the origin of the Breach's Bible. In about 1870, the first great effort was made to revise the Bible. Perhaps it was an audacious move, because to the average person, the Bible is or was written in English by God, just the way he had it. As my old aunt used to say, without a jot or a tittle being out of place. One small boy in Sunday school said that the Bible was written by St. James in England in 1611. Don't know the way people feel about it. But anyway, an effort was made to completely bring it back to the oldest and best manuscripts with the most direct and simple translations in the idiom of the time. That is, in the idiom of the period in which the book was first known to have existed. In doing so, the Old Testament was considerably changed. Job and several other works were put back into verse, which is the way they were originally written. Many changes were made. The chapter divisions were changed, because in all the early versions, the chapter divisions are different from what we have now. All important interpolations after the 5th or 6th century were noted and bracketed so that the individual could tell what had been added after the basic manuscript. And many efforts were made to bring it into a complete integration. One effort also included the effort to put together again the four Gospels and make the one story as nearly as it could possibly be restored according to Jerusalem. Of course, the move received no support whatever, because the situation has become so associated with the public mind that this kind of procedure is comparatively worthless from the public standpoint. There is nothing. The wording, the old form, has become so near and dear to their hearts that they are not interested in any further variations on it. Therefore, all such work belongs definitely on the level of biblical criticism. It belongs among those who are studying these things in the original languages or are re-editing and revising them for serious research. But that there is a tremendous field of research here, and that it is important to a world in which there are 600 million Christians who are concerned about their own book and want to understand more, not only of its contents, but how it came into being. Because most people are interested. We are interested in the families of our friends. We're interested in their backgrounds. We're interested in the physical association, I guess, of persons and things in which we have a deep attachment. And it is inevitable that a Christian world should want to understand its book, to want to know its content and its source, and if possible, restore any errors, mistakes, or deletions that may have come in. And that is what this criticism is for, and it also hopes to leave a certain general overtone of a larger and more generous and understanding approach to the subject, and perhaps, as biblical criticism of the day points, less emphasis upon detail and more upon the large ethical and spiritual motions of the context. Because for centuries, detail has divided people. And biblical criticism of the day is away from detail by eliminating as secondary those things which are not held in common, and emphasizing those things which are held in common. And out of this criticism comes greater tendency to think in the terms of the Sermon on the Mount than to think in the terms of the genealogies. Both may have their place, but for the average person, it is the great ethical and moral structure, the spiritual dynamic, that is of greater importance than the historical background. The historical background may help us to clear certain ambiguous and confusing characters. And we know we have 500 sects of Christendom today, and probably 400 of those sects only exist because of confusing translations of the Scriptures, in which the individual cannot be sure of the original meaning. And therefore, he has gradually, over a period of time, built up a tremendous the divisional emphasis. Because where we know the facts, there is very little difference of opinion. But where the facts are not known, opinion dominates. So the correction of certain faults might have a tremendous power in bringing Christendom back together again, as today the biblical student is trying to put together this book, to reveal as clearly and simply and directly as you can the tremendous dynamic of the subject. Well, I think that's enough for a warm evening.